This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, with me at Joyce Go and Kusu Chuang. The morning run begins its steep ascent to the stratosphere. It's the 7th of November, with the penultimate month of the year. And very exciting for that, because for some of us, 2017 has been, well, less than stellar. We're looking forward to a new year. Are you looking forward to a new year, Chuang?
Yes, very much so. I can't wait for this year to be over,
I can't believe that, you know, you're here. In fact, Joyce, I can't believe you're both not out in Penang, you know, building banks.
Salvationing and rescuing and boating and stuff.
Boating? Know. Well, yeah. That sounds a bit boating with tea and crumpets.
Well, not the...
like a boating with your little hat, top hat.
Yes, you know. Paper. You're right.
Well, it's quite devastating. Have your friends and families been affected by the floods in Penang?
Quote unquote, my mate said Penang is like a war zone. There's stuff everywhere. There's debris air all over the place.
Right. Yeah, I keep getting messages and photos on WhatsApp from like relatives and friends sending, "Oh, this happened," and videos and all that.
And in fact, I actually didn't realize, but on Facebook, there's a Facebook page posting clearly of people I know who've sort of who put there whether they're safe or not, right? It's like, I'm okay, you know, so they're Penang based, just to kind of alert their friends about the fact that they're safe and dry. Now, people who are not quite so safe, Paradise Papers, that scandal brewing globally, has already dragged into its clutches the United Kingdom's monarch, the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II. Also, the Irish singer Bono are there, because it shows that he has a stake in a Lithuanian mall that might have evaded taxes. Also, the senior aide to Canada's Justin Trudeau, and many others. Do these stories, really curl your toes?
What do you mean, curl my toes?
I mean, well, there's a journalist, a financial journalist, but kind of like ripping the mask off of the actions of the super rich.
I think people in Malaysia forget the fact that the media are here for a reason. The fact that the media are the fourth leg or the fourth estate to balance the supervening power sometimes of the authorities.
I must admit that when news came out about the Paradise Papers, we were like, but... who are the local people? I mean, for us journalists, it's like...
Actually, I saw some of my friends there on that list.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, the Panama Papers.
Oh, have you?
Hanging out with the rich and
famous? No. I mean, but these are normal, typical corporate guys. And even some who didn't control listed companies but had stuff abroad.
I see.
They all appeared in the Panama Papers.
But Paradise Papers, have any yet?
Paradise, I haven't seen yet. I'm going to check soon.
You know, there's 1,400 gigabytes of data containing 13.4 million documents. Now, there's going
there's
to take
a certain Sharad Kutan there, is it? 1.4
Not at
terabytes.
All. I mean, look, honestly, I mean, I don't own a media business. I work for somebody. I'm a wage slave, dude. And, you know, people like me don't have, you know, the kind of cash that needs to be protected in this fashion. It's going to be an interesting story, because as it unfolds, there are different types of ways in which people have been, you know, implicated by this. For instance, the British monarch, it's through the, I think, the investment company of the Crown that had put some money, not too much, I think it was a couple of million, like 10 million, into a particular, you know, other company. And so the question was this seemly...
The accusation was that this company which she invested was involved in unethical practices.
That's
like child labor.
The lending practice, practices.
But you know what, right? Although some of these transactions might be quite small in nature, it is the principle behind it, which is the far-reaching web of the media and the accountability it demands from high-profile.
Fascinating stuff. So we'll be back with more. In fact, we'll be back with some other fishy business. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Electric Light Orchestra with a Showdown. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Joyce Go and Kusu Chuang. It's a showdown indeed in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. We've had that spectacular purge, ostensibly in a move against corrupt practices in the kingdom. That's taken down one of the richest men in the world. I think Leicester is the 50th richest man in the world, as well as other royals and people likely to form perhaps opposition to the succession of the present king's son, Mohammed bin Salman.
You are, of course, referring to the Saudi Arabia counter-coup, isn't it? The purge there, as it were.
No, well, not a counter-coup. It is, in some ways, a kind of palace coup because his father is the king. He's said to be the power behind the throne. And in order to secure his succession to the throne, they seem to have taken out a whole bunch of people. It's very unclear how these loyalties are, but there's a complex architecture of power in the kingdom and several families that are implicated in this particular purge. So I think it's a fascinating story. It's, you know, it's got all the makings of Dynasty, Knots Landing and Bewitched.
Knots Landing.
Knots Landing.
You just introduced a little pop culture phrase from the 70s.
Yeah, and well, Dynasty as well.
Yeah.
Dynasty, right. Okay. Yeah. Now, moving on to a story that, of course, made it big. It was there on the television screens yesterday. First part of his five-nation tour, Donald Trump, the president of the United States of America, in a little ceremony feeding koi, is said to have lost his patience and dumped a whole bunch of food, fish food, that is, into the pond. Now, subsequently, it was shown that he was actually only following on Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan, who did the same. And so Shinzo Abe did it first, then Trump. But Trump was singled out. It looked like and was framed as if he was the guy who initiated and because he was impatient. The question before us is, are we too quick to judge some people or think the worst of some people?
Sharad, good question. I this is a good scenario to point that out. And perhaps it's also the media and how they portrayed, they zoomed in onto Trump, right? Rather than Abe, who had started already pouring all the fish food into the pond, right? And but then again, I don't know, is Trump an easy target for them?
Target because most times he will, of his own volition, do something that's crass and silly and say something out of turn and, you know, not follow protocol, et cetera, et cetera. But still, the media does have a responsibility to get the story right, doesn't it?
Well, look, I mean, not to de-intellectualize this conversation, but I have fed koi in Japan itself. And I've been
fed koi.
Stood on the edge of a pond and, you know, the koi are pretty large creatures, you know. I mean, they can be about four or five feet long. So, they've got massive mouths and they love. So this is.
So does Donald Trump.
Correct. So which is what I'm trying to get to. There's a Freudian element to this, you see, Sharad, because it's kind of like he gives the people what they want. He gives the koi what they want. He just, you know, instead of just giving these little measly morsels, he just chucks the whole thing in. And so what I would do, that's exactly what I did.
He was just following Abe's lead. I mean, Trump was just following Abe's lead.
And Abe is one who also gives the people what they want. Right?
Well, I think, but what's important is that the media framed it as him being impatient, right? So we have this, Donald Trump has a reputation, right? And it's a well-earned reputation for being somebody who is quite impatient, who does not deal with niceties. He's no, Barack Obama. He's not smooth and elegant and well-crafted.
He's not the last word in diplomacy, put it that way.
No,
right?
He isn't, right? But the thing is still, and this goes back to, so for all those Donald Trump supporters, and I can't count myself as one of them, they would be saying, "This is, see what this is? This is what the media does. It unfairly targets Donald Trump. It shows him to be a buffoon when he in fact isn't, that he's in fact the elegant, sophisticated billionaire that he claims to be. Et cetera. But the thing is, does Donald Trump deserve the bad press that he's getting?
Well, the headlines, I must say, some of the things that he says as a journalist, I also find it as a good headline. You know, it makes news.
So yeah, it's quotable, right?
Yeah, right. It's a quotable quote. It's good soundbite. So I can't help it if he's giving all these things, right? And they're lapping it up, right?
Much like how he feeds the koi. He just shoves the whole box into the pond rather than just doling them out little bit by little bit.
You know, what was quite surprising was when I was following Twitter and I was very quick to comment on this thing. And, you know, I said something rude like, toilet training hashtag or whatever. And then, but then I read through the story and discovered that, in fact, Abe had been the first to do it. So then I went and deleted my tweet, which is, you know, well, something you can do if nobody's already retweeted it. But
a WhatsApp message within 7 minutes.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an act of contrition. I mean, I did feel that, yeah, I too am guilty sometimes of being very quick
jumping
on the trigger.
Jumping to conclusions, love.
When it comes to something like Donald Trump, because he has a reputation. I mean, I think his
defenders... But isn't that human nature? Isn't it human nature to jump to conclusions?
Or to what, to
superficial,
judge?
Yeah, judgment. And, oh, she's a such and such, or he's a such and such, because he's from so and so and so, where and where.
But I guess some people have this preconceived notion. Like, they form their own idea of this person already. So sometimes it can be unfair.
Well, it's a bit like if you're from Penang and then people say, oh, he's from Penang, therefore he must be Kiam Siap Lai.
Exactly.
Exactly, right?
We're miserly.
Or,
you know, you're what? Miserly?
Frugal.
Miserly, yeah.
Oh, frugal. That's a nice way of putting it. Mm. You turn into a virtue.
Prudent. Fiscal prudence.
Okay, we'll be back and talk about the jungle. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Kusu Chuang there, sneezing his lungs out.
Excuse me, more.
Yeah, and Joyce Goh, myself, Sharad Kutin. It's just after 21 minutes, after 6 o'clock in the morning. It's because it's 7th of November, and it's pelting out there. It's quite rainy, quite rainy. We were talking earlier about the big purge in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. There's one going on in Zimbabwe right now. Zimbabwe's vice president has been removed because he displayed traits of disloyalty. Observers expect Mugabe, who's 93, for Mugabe's wife, to step into the breach. Very interesting there that you have the purge, as well as, you know, nepotism. What else could you call it? Now, we turn our attentions to the visiting monarch, Prince Charles of the United Kingdom. He's here on a 10-day visit. He, together with the Duchess of Cornwall, were in Sarawak yesterday and stopped by the Sarawak Cultural Village. Now, the prince seized on a chance to try his hand at dart blowing, because it's a traditional weapon for many of the communities in Sarawak. And now this was framed in a newspaper in England as Charles, the king of the jungle, being taught an ancient skill by a, you know, tribesman. And that exactly is the language. And, you know, I first read it, I thought, well, this is a tad offensive, isn't it?
Well, you know, if we talk about Donald Trump being the subject of media attention for something of the wrong reasons, Prince Charles is the original target for ridicule with his big nose and his big ears and, you know, being the ugly side of the Charles Diner, partnership through the years, and his partner in Camilla Parker Bowles, who does resemble certain four-legged animals, etc., etc.
Oh my goodness, I would never have gone that far. Okay, your point being, Mr. Well,
So being the target of media attention, sometimes he's portrayed in a certain way, right? So, I mean, what better an August publication than The Telegraph to frame Prince Charles?
The Independent, actually, I think.
I've got The Telegraph unopened. Right. They'll
okay.
frame, you know, there's the king of the empire, the British Empire, the right. once mighty British Empire, lording it over the colonials.
I must say, you know, when you're royalty and all that, you get this kind of attention that some of them, they haven't asked for it. Yeah, they don't.
It's not so much, I think, Charles's fault in this case, right? It's not about how he framed it. It was how the media did it. So, right, just pointing to the Telegraph, and the headline reads, Prince Charles is king of the jungle as he learns how to blow darts like Borneo tribesmen. I mean, it just feels
it's thick with irony. It's thick with innuendos of British colonialism.
Of exoticizing the East. I mean, he's come all the way. I mean, Sarawak has been independent for like 50 years, right? I mean, yeah, they actually had a British monarch, right? The Brookes ruled them for many generations. But I think what's interesting is this tendency to want to frame us, you know, this part of the world as being from the jungle, as being tribes people, even if the children of these tribes people are now studying at universities around and maybe, you know, developing an app or something, still will only ever have darts and blowpipes.
When I went to school in England in the early 80s, right, and, you know, in the mid 80s, people in my house, my boarding house, asked me, so where are you from? And I said, Malaysia. And they said, where is that? And I said, you know where Singapore is? I said, north of that, right? And then they asked me, do you have electricity in your country? And I said, yes, we do. And
were they shocked that you could speak English?
Yes, they were. And they were even more shocked when I did better in my exams than they did. And then they asked me, do you have McDonald's? And I said, no, but we've got running water, to which they gave me this wide-eyed astonishment. And then later on, you know, through the years, right, Jeremy Clarkson with Top Gear, there was one time he did a very famous episode when he took a mallet to Perador Kalisa, to a kanchil. And he proceeded to smash the car with this mallet. And then he said, this car is made by a few Asians in a jungle clearing in Southeast Asia.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. And then obviously it went viral, right, this video. But obviously the Malaysians were
Well, you know,
amused.
What's really interesting, I mean, I think I would take offense, except that I'm much more tickled by this.
Yeah, it's
because,
quite
I mean,
funny.
You think of England, I mean, what do they make? They don't make cars. At least we make cars. I mean, do they make anything
they make
back
stuffy,
in Jolly?
They produce
scones and tea.
They produce stuffy individuals who resemble animals.
Okay, well, okay, enough slagging off the, you know, the Brits. But, you know, what it is fascinating that in this day and age, this is the favoured frame for doing stories about this part of the world. Anyway, taking us all the way up to the first bulletin of the morning, Matchbox 20 and Real World. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Curtis Mayfield and Superfly. Joyce Goh, Kusu Chuang, myself, Sharad Kutin. And the morning run continues 40 minutes after 6 on the 7th of November. Remember, you can join us in this conversation at any point in time by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. And you can always be part of this conversation. Now, the conversation carries on to the question of children, and I know the both of you have, you know, quite a number. You're almost reaching replacement rate with your reproductivity. But in
what are you on about,
in South Africa,
what have you been consuming?
A court in South Africa has recently ruled that you cannot spank your kids. Now, there used to be on the books a law that says there's something called reasonable chastisement. You could punish your kids physically for reasons that some people might consider, justified. Now, that's been taken off the books, apparently, in South Africa. There's now almost no defense for smacking your kids. Now, as people who actually have children, unlike myself, who's not as reproductive, you know, I give the world memes. You guys give the world genes. Tell us.
Hey, you've been consuming something dodgy in the morning.
Do you think that you should not have the right to smack your kids?
I believe disciplining the kids, I mean, that is important. Smacking kids, I mean, when it comes to, if it crosses the line to physical abuse, then, yeah, I mean, then that's wrong. But if it's to discipline the kids, I use the naughty corner often on my kids.
I think we should have one at BFM, a naughty corner. It sounds intriguing and mysterious.
And that seems to work, I think, because they're still young. But of course, if it's really, really bad, then the rotan will come out, lah. But it's
more. Oh, it does. You do have
on
a rotan.
Haven't you ever watched Russell Peters, Sharad? That's a very, very astute observation about Asian parents and children. I'm serious, right? But the thing is, because my kids are like me, and naughty corners don't work, it needs a higher level of admonishment, and that's why it's at some point in time, it's quite interesting to pull out the rotan, because that's the only thing that sometimes they respond to.
You know,
but it's a very Asian thing.
But the question is it right? And is this the kind of practice that we want to take moving forward? And should the law and the state be involved in all this?
Well, it's actually very interesting, because when you look at the developed world versus the undeveloped world, and I'd say we in Asia are largely undeveloped.
Or undeveloping.
Developing. Most of the developed world have, child legislation, right? And which, of course, includes provisioning on physical beating and caning and all that. I mean, very famously, a few years ago, the couple, the Malaysian couple in Sweden were, you know, at risk. In fact, they were imprisoned for beating the children. So, but you see, because I've studied abroad and I've, you know, bisected both civilizations, I have noticed that the kids and the young in the developed world tend to be more or less disciplined or less well behaved than the Asian kids.
But you think, is it a case of spare the rod and spoil the child?
That's a gross generalization. But
do you think also it's culture? Perhaps when it's the Asian culture. There's the whole respect, like where you call your parents daddy, mummy.
Yeah.
In the Western world, sometimes they call them by name.
Harold, Jane, or whatever. Yeah, and they're 7 years old.
In Australia, where they call their parents by name.
Okay,
right?
So that's a slightly different order of things. But you're saying it's all under one rubric, right? The question of discipline, respect, and such. But is there a possibility that parents sometimes forget that their children are human beings with rights? And when it comes to physical punishment, go overboard.
Yeah, that's why I feel that if it crosses the line and if it's physical abuse, then that's wrong.
So who makes that judgment, though? I mean, and I think this is the problem, right? In a rules-based society like ours and many countries in South Africa as well, the law often is established so that there's some way of deciding, where that line is. But what the courts in South Africa have done is actually taken away the defense that parents could use of reasonable chastisement.
I don't think there's a hard and fast rule because it's basically whose word governs the child. Should it be the administration and the government over the parents? And I think in certain extreme cases, the government does need to step in because obviously some parents are not fit to be a parent, right? But I think by and large, and I would include people like Joyce and myself in this room, I mean, we do know, I mean, what's best for our children rather than the government who... Let's just put it this way, right? Doesn't know a lot about anything generally.
I believe disciplining is important, I guess. And when they're young, especially, they don't know yet, and we're there to teach them in a way. For me, as I said, they're still young, so the naughty corner works. I'm not so sure when they're older whether that will work or not. So
I'm going to institute a naughty corner in my house.
What
Joyce talked about earlier in terms of the cultural differences is very telling because, you know, Asians and our Asian governments tend to be very overbearing, omnipresent, authoritative, very, very much top-down approach. And, you know, in governments in China, Malaysia, Singapore, you know, very much ruled by one person or one party. It's a very tight control.
Yeah, but, you know, and so surprisingly...
And therefore, the parents and the children have the same kind of like... framework, right?
But it's also true of many liberal Western democracies where rules governing things like how you treat your children or, you know, when you can put garbage out on the street and stuff, also very, very elaborate. And so it's not so laissez-faire as one might think in those countries, oddly enough. You know, the authoritarianism sort of expresses itself in a different way, doesn't it? Well, there's so much to talk about, but we're running out of time. We'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang. It's 52 minutes past 6. And time to talk about not young people, but older people. That was the Velvet Underground, by the way, if you're interested to know what you're listening to. Now, the northern states, as we know, and Penang in particular, Kedah as well, been suffering from a flash floods following torrential downpours. In Penang, it claimed 7 lives, and 4 of those 7 were senior citizens. And of course, I think we've all seen those viral images of elderly residents trapped in floodwaters. Now, we spoke to Dr. Nora Nakia Binti Muhammad Hariri, professor of social and preventive medicine at University of Malaya, about the risks that are faced by older people in flood disasters.
The thing about older people is that their various degree of in terms of health, but I suppose many older people are actually able to cope by themselves, but there are some who might be living alone or they might be living together with their spouse, but their spouse are also elderly as well, or they might just be isolated, say living in rural area, or some might also have certain medical or health conditions. And basically, extreme weather or flood affects people of all ages, but some older people are even more prone to issues or conditions like this. So I think these are the things that we should look into, make them be more prepared.
Speaking of helping older people to be prepared for disasters, we asked Dr. Noran for some advice.
I think there are a few things that we can actually do. So the idea is to get ourselves prepared. And some of the tips or general ideas would be things like having a flat kit or a kit of emergency supplies. So things like basic supplies, things like food, and then that water, especially clean water, a week-long supply of your medicine and your supplies, eyeglasses, your spectacles, your hearing aids, and then the hearing aids batteries and things like that. So these are some of the things that's useful to have it prepared. Phone numbers, important phone numbers, that those are the things that you have to have. Then another thing is, of course, making a plan or at least see the living arrangements among older people in Malaysia right now has changed. So we have quite a number of older people, and then we've got a number of them who are actually living alone, or some of them are actually living with their spouse, and some of them who have children who are working elsewhere. So one is you need to have a family communication plan. Say, for example, if the children is working in Kuala Lumpur and the parents are staying up north, the family might not be together, but then there should be a way of a plan of how you would contact one another whenever you have this kind of situation, right? Neighbor support, friend support, that's very, very useful to have. You need to make sure that you know where to go or how to evacuate in case of emergency. But one of the things that we also must acknowledge is that when it comes to things like floods, it does cause anxiety, nervousness. These feelings of distress is real, and support from family and friends would be very important at this point in time.
That was Dr. Nora Nakia Mohamed Hairi, Professor of Social and Preventive Medicine at University of Malaya. Speaking about older people and disaster situations, I guess in any disaster situation, the more vulnerable you are, whether you're very young or you're very old or you are incapacitated in any way, just makes that experience that much more difficult to cope with. But, you know, I think especially when I look at the generation ahead of me, many of them are very independent. So, you know, I'm used to older people, even those in their 80s, living alone, living independently and being very headstrong when it comes to, you know, having control over their own environment and their decision making.
Yes, yeah, so the doctor is saying that we should have a flood kit ready with emergency supplies. But this thing that happened in Penang, it kind of happened. I don't think anyone saw it coming. It just one day just started raining, and suddenly flooded. You know, and it was surprising. And I think it caught many by surprise. I know my friends definitely were, my relatives were. They didn't expect it to be until this bad.
I mean, I think there's some dispute now as to whether the Met Department put out the warnings too late. I think the Federation of Penang Manufacturers came out to say that. But in their defense, they came out and said that in fact, they had issued a warning 4 days before. And so, well, so that aside, the question of old people.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, you know, old people will be old people
like you and me,
Sharad, will be in trouble in any situation, let alone floods. And I think in terms of where the blame should lie, everybody's complicit in this, from the state government to the planning authorities from way back when, to overdevelopment and a too strong property developer lobby. Even the parents or the children of the elderly should also. I mean, everybody is contributory to the issue. I think going forward is the most important issue here. What do we do about not just the elderly, but also in terms of Penang as a place for people to live? And I think these are serious questions that the Consumer Association of Penang has rightly brought up, because do we want to live in a place which is constantly at risk of being flooded, or do we want to live in a safe, habitable place?
Yeah, it was never like that, wasn't it? It didn't flood until so bad. I don't remember it being like that. Do you remember it being like that, Chuan?
Actually, the truth of the matter is Georgetown has always been at risk and has been through many, many similar
there
situations
floods,
in the past.
But not until to this so, not until
and,
so bad.
And look, this is climate change. And it only will get worse, right? Newspapers this morning talking about more rains to come, and they're right.
Yeah, in fact, I think the rains that came over the weekend were highest in recorded history. So quite an unusual situation there. We'll be back with more after this. We're coming up to the top of the hour. There'll be the news and then more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh and Kusu Chuang. It's just after 7 minutes past seven on the 7th of November. Oh, 777 there. Must be auspicious. Now, the week, the Edge Weekly's recent cover story looked at the growing wealth gap in Malaysia and cited DM Analytics chief economist Mohamed Abdul Khalid, who said that GDP growth rates do not matter as much as the actual situation when it comes to looking at the question of wealth. Now, note that we saw GDP grow from 4.2% last year to 5.8% in the second quarter of this year. Now, despite the growth, it doesn't feel like the man in the street is really benefiting from this growth. We spoke to Dr. Lee Hock An. He's a senior fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore, and asked him about the story behind the GDP numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, it's still, you know, quite perplexing. We have not only just the GDP growth, but also recently was released the household income data that's calculated from the household income survey, also showing quite substantial growth. I think we need to get a better handle on this income situation. So, you know, GDP per capita is this, you know, big macro picture, but how that is distributed and how that actually translates into incomes is really what matters for household purchasing power. And this quite high household income growth that has been reported for 2014 to 2016, about 4.3% per year in real terms, that's quite perplexing because, again, as you were saying, the sense on the ground is quite the contrary. There's a widespread discontent and sense that wage growth is slow and income growth is slow.
So we asked him to help us understand how household income numbers are obtained.
Yes, household income surveys. It's a massive exercise that samples 80,000 or so households around the country to get a representative picture of what is happening and actually asking people, you know, what is your income and what are the sources. I mean, there are others as well, and it's good to check against things like the EPF accounts because that derives from wages in the private sector. There's also the wages and salaries survey. And my research in this, you know, together with Dr. Mohamed Abdul Khalid, you know, we have found that the growth based on some of these other data sources is not as high as, you know, what has been reported through other sources.
So we also asked him if he could help us understand what household income growth, why household income growth isn't as high as reported.
One thing that I have noticed looking at the household income data is that what is reported to us is highly aggregated, including wages and salaries, self-employment. It also includes property and investment income and transfers. So all of that is lumped together. And I think that's where we need to unpack that a little bit because a lot of the high income growth is driven by very high growth in property income and transfers, and I think some of that is implausibly high growth of, you know, 10 to 11% per year in the last 2 years, whereas even in the household income survey statistics, household wages and salaries, so that's the income you get from work, the growth there is significantly slower than property income. Household and wages and salaries, it's been growing at about 2 to 3%. So this is only really a partial answer because the information that we have is very limited. But again, you know, I just want to drive the point that I think we don't understand and we're not very informed enough about what's happening with household income. And that is a better reflection of people's purchasing power and, you know, households' ability to afford things that they need.
That was Lee Hock An, a senior fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore, talking about the gap between the rather positive GDP numbers and the feel on the ground that's rather pessimistic or negative.
Yeah, so it's this whole salary, whether it's rising or not, and the income gap. And we, as you know, recently Bank Negara came out with this Housing Watch website that shows data, and it shows that what salary is at, what's the median salary? I think 60 over 1,000 I think the annual household income is estimated to be only 63,000 ringgit, right? And that's the median annual household income. And the bulk of new homes cost between up to 500,000. So you can see that's the gap there. You can see income is not rising as fast as house prices are. I think that was basically what Bank Negara was trying to show.
Yeah, I think a lot of this pain, a lot of this debate is happening because of the imperfect science that economics is, essentially. Because what economics tries to do and economic data tries to do is try and capture the zeitgeist in terms of a household wage, the whole bunch of economic metrics, which they don't obviously portray accurately exactly the situation on the ground. Because we have read through, we've combed through all these numbers in the last few months, and we've been stymied, essentially, because the numbers don't bear up when you are actually on the ground trying to make it happen as a family or as a father or as a mother on the ground in the Klang Valley. And, of course, the situation will differ if you live in Parit Bunta, if you live in Taiping, or even if you live in the barrio. So, you know, it's very hard to get a real strong picture from economic numbers alone.
You know, what's most disturbing is when an economist says it's perplexing. And
exactly.
They themselves,
exactly.
Or in this case one person, is stumped by is it a question merely of a perception gap? We've talked about this over and over again, a slight disconnect. We talked about the optimism deficit. We have these great numbers and yet there's pessimism on the ground. And yet nobody seems to be able to really put a finger on what exactly is happening.
Well, you also have employers telling employees, "Oh, times are tough, it's challenging, you know, maybe salaries can't go up so high this year, maybe no bonus because, you know, the business not good." And a number of my friends have shared with me, you know, it's tough, company not doing well, there are job cuts. So again, there's this disconnect.
Well, I think it's quite appropriate and quite timely for the Edge Weekly to run the story describing the wealth gap between Malaysians. And, you know, this is actually a global phenomenon, the disparity between the wealthy and the not wealthy. And, you know, someone like Jeffrey Sachs, he quite rightly put it, this is something he's made a big deal of for a number of years already. He's saying that the biggest social problem facing the world today is the gap between the haves and the have-nots. Because if you don't distribute wealth well enough around everybody within your country, you will have social strife, you will have crime, you will have grief on a monumental scale, because as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, they will rise up. And this is what the Sex Pistols sung about in the 70s, which is anarchy again in the UK.
You know, I was listening to the conversation on Bloomberg yesterday when they talked about, you know, how Americans accept a certain level of inequality. They can deal with inequality.
There's a pain level,
Yeah, they can deal with differences in income and wealth. But what is a problem now, this analyst said, was the question of opportunities. Now, when people feel that there are no opportunities, that access to opportunities are shrinking, that's when you get the trouble. Because at least in an American context, the feeling is that your wealth or your income is a symptom of your ability or talent or the energy you put behind something.
You have control on how.
The problem is when you don't have opportunities, when you feel you're being squeezed out of opportunities, that becomes a source of social resentment.
And stateside, you've got something like 50 million Americans in the world's richest country on food stamps. And I just want to write sites, not inappropriately, 2 days ago, was it last night, 26 people shot dead in a church in America. And this is basically a country which has got very few opportunities for the disenfranchised, and they've got access to guns. So in Malaysia, right, it's very different, because Malaysia is still full of opportunities. We're abundant with the opportunities for the entrepreneur, for the working class, etc. So we don't have those problems right now. And we don't have a gun. We do have gun laws, which is you can't own a gun, which is obviously
way
forward.
Control. I mean, some people do have
absolutely,
guns.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But yeah, you know, big issues for us because of the political implications of inequality, as you rightly put it there. We'll be back with more analysis. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.